And a diamond mine in Botswana keeps finding an unusual number of big diamonds. It's called the Karowe mine. And last year, it unearthed the world's largest rough diamond. And more have emerged since. The mine is owned by a Canadian company, run by a woman. And indeed, many of the mine's management are women. And that's not all that makes Karowe Mine extraordinary. Journalist Ed Caesar told me about the huge rough diamond.
The world's largest rough diamond is called Sewelo, which means a rare find in Setswana. And it is a 1,758-carat diamond that was dug out of a big hole in the ground in Botswana. And it's big enough that even me with my big former second row forward hands can't get my hand all the way around it. It's bigger than a baseball, whatever you want to call it. It weighs the same as a can of soup. It is enormous, and it is covered in this unusual black rind, which is unusual for a rough diamond. But there is white, very valuable stone within it. So it's this big, enigmatic, very odd-looking diamond, and it's the second largest rough diamond ever found.
What was the first?
The first was the Cullinan diamond. That was more than 3,000 carats, and the stones that came out of that, the polished diamonds that came out of that, and now one of them's in the Queen's Royal Scepter, one of them's in her crown. There are some other colour offshoots spread around the royal family. That was found in the early years of the 20th century at someone called Thomas Cullinan's mine in South Africa, near where the great diamond rush started, near Kimberley.
If this second largest rough diamond, the Sewelo, is covered with black rind, how do we know that it's of high quality inside?
We don't, not really. So that's one of the interesting things about this diamond. There are moments when you can see into it. So there are parts where the black rind isn't all the way around it. And the people that have taken a long time looking at it are confident that there's 200, 250 carats of white diamond inside. But the honest answer is that nobody really knows until they start polishing windows, which is little panels where you could see into the interior. Nobody knows until those are polished what's actually inside this diamond.
I want to talk about the mine that found it, because they've got some very interesting practices, not only in terms of mining, but also in terms of retail. But I just want to ask you, what makes a piece of rock so valuable? How did that come about?
Well, this is a question with either a very long answer or a very short answer. But the truth is that diamonds don't really have huge intrinsic value. They look pretty when you polish them up. They sparkle. They're hard. But their value far outstrips what you might call their intrinsic worth, whatever that might be. And really, you know, the diamond rush started in the 19th century, but the real added value that came to these stones was presented through the publicity and the advertising work of American firms in the 1930s on behalf of De Beers, who were the world's biggest diamond cartel. And it was them who really convinced us, in the words of their slogan, "A diamond is forever." They taught prospective grooms about how to judge a diamond's quality. They put this idea out that, you know, the only proper stone to give your fiance was a diamond. And this idea grew. You know, diamonds have always been considered, not always, but for a long time, been considered the things that aristocrats gave each other since about the Middle Ages, at least. But this idea that everyone should be giving their fiancé a diamond is really a very modern idea. So they're not intrinsically valuable. They're valuable because other people have said they're valuable. And that idea is, if you wanted to give it a name, you'd call it mimetic desire, I guess. You know, you're copying someone else who thinks they're valuable.
And now people can make diamonds. I mean, you can have synthetic diamonds. Will that not affect the value that we put on them?
I think it does affect the value. It tends to be at the lower end of the value spectrum for diamonds. So big, real, original, you know, diamonds will still have their value. I think the area of the market that it might affect is the smaller diamond market. But, you know, when you talk to diamond producers, they would say, you know, it's already make a difference in terms of how people think about diamonds, and maybe not exclusively for the bad in terms of diamond producers, because they are now being able to say, well, if you want the real thing, you have to come to us, whereas these synthetic diamonds, you know, are not the real thing. So it differentiates the two types of products.
Yeah, even though only an expert with a microscope could tell the difference. What was it about this Canadian mining company, Lucara, that made you think it was a good story?
Lucara is super interesting because they not only have found some of the biggest rough diamonds in history, but they've done it in a remarkably short space of time. And they have done it because they have innovated the procedure by which you find diamonds. So they have really pioneered the use of this technology called XRT, which is essentially like a baggage scanner. And to find a diamond, you're mining a huge amount of ore. And what you need to do is to find these tiny little bits of carbon in this huge amount of other non-valuable material. And traditionally, there have been ways to do that. You can sort the material by weight. You can sort it using grease paper because diamonds behave slightly differently on that surface than other material. You can do it using luminescence. But what these guys at Lucara did with their mine in Botswana is that they used this baggage scanning-like technology to pick out the items that had a carbon signature. And what it meant was that they didn't have to crush the diamonds so many times before they got to the sorting phase. And that meant that when they found a really big diamond, they weren't breaking it before it got to the final stage.
That seems so bizarre, doesn't it? That in order to find a big diamond, you have to risk smashing it up.
Yeah, but they're so, you know, really big diamonds are so rare that in a sense, you know, people have made that bargain that, you know, you just need to find the volume of diamonds rather than look for the big ones. But at Lucara, they realized they have this very special deposit where they do have occasionally very big diamonds and they want to preserve those. So that's very interesting about them. But there's also just a very interesting social story. They're led by a woman who has been a real pioneer in the diamond field, Ira Thomas, a Canadian. You know, most of their senior management team are women. About half the workforce in Botswana itself are women. It's a progressive company that's doing innovative things, and it just seemed like an extremely interesting story about what a company in a space like diamonds can look like. You know, when you think about diamonds, you perhaps think about blood diamonds, you perhaps think about really bad working practices. And actually, it was remarkable to go and see a company that was not only doing things the right way, but also, you know, they're putting a lot back into the nation of Botswana.
So does Botswana not suffer from the resource curse?
Botswana, quite the opposite, I think. I've traveled and reported in a lot of the countries that do suffer from the resource curse, which is this idea that if you have a lot of resources, often it works against you because the resource is mismanaged, there's corruption. So the absolute best example of that where I've been is Democratic Republic of Congo, which has so many different types of valuable resource and has been criminally mismanaged for decades. And the average citizen in the DRC does not have a good quality of life. In Botswana, diamonds have underpinned a huge increase in average wealth because the Botswanan government has taxed and sought levies from foreign diamond producers in the country. And they have put those profits back into things like education, things like healthcare. And there really has been a tangible benefit to having diamonds for Botswana.
I'm talking to Ed Caesar about diamonds. The other thing that Ira Thomas is doing differently is the way she's putting the diamond on the market. She wants, as I understand it, to maintain her relationship with the diamond after it goes through the sale process. What is she doing?
I think what she's trying to do is to reimagine what a miner's place in the diamond market is. So traditionally, a miner has simply found stones and then sold them at tender and then walked away. So you walk away with a big check or a little check, but whatever happens, that's the end of your role. And some of these stones are so extraordinary that Lucara have found that she has been trying to imagine a different way to be in the marketplace. And what she wants to do is to stay involved with these special big stones. So she retains an interest in Sewelo, even though it's been bought by Louis Vuitton. And so that's a very interesting and new model. The other thing that she has done is she has harnessed blockchain technology, which allows her to run a marketplace called Clara, which is essentially a way of teaming up a seller of a diamond with a buyer without so many intermediaries, because each diamond has a unique shape and size and can be sort of registered in the blockchain that way. And so in a number of different ways, Ira and Lucara have really tried to rethink how the diamond market itself works.
And this has not endeared Ira Thomas and Lucara to the traditionalists, has it?
No, I mean, there is a established, very closed world of diamond dealers. If you go to the diamond bourse in Antwerp, you'll meet most of them. And they like things the way they are because middlemen make money. And if a diamond passes through a lot of pairs of hands before it reaches, you know, the ears of or the fingers of its ultimate clients, then every single person on that chain is going to make money. And what Ira is doing is she's saying it makes no sense for a diamond to pass through this many hands. And essentially she's picking the pockets of those middlemen. So that has not endeared her universally to the diamantaires.
Do you think that what they're doing, both in terms of their processing, not turning everything to such small rubble, and using the X-ray transmission technology, and also what they're doing in the market, do you think that this will force a widespread change in the way the industry operates?
I think that's hard to say. The XRT technology that they have at Lucara in Botswana works extremely well for this particular deposit. It might not be as economic for a different type of deposit where you are only turning up smaller diamonds. You know, maybe the old-fashioned way of doing things would actually work just as well in that scenario. I think that you'd be crazy to look at Lucara and think you couldn't learn anything. So you look at their run of success, you look at how they stayed profitable at a time when a lot of diamond producers were struggling. You know, it's a success story. And it's a success story because they have supple thinkers who adapt to the particular circumstances in which they find themselves. So I think all of that is it can't help but be interesting to other diamond producers. One of the things to say is there are aspects of Lucara's approach that exist in other places, but they're really the first people to put it all together. So certainly the XRT technology has become much more popular since Lucara have been finding these big stones.
And what is the estimate of how much the Sewelo is worth?
Well, that's another hard question to answer, because the value is, as a rough diamond, you can't say for sure. It had an export value in the low millions, between 3 and 4 million US dollars. But if you're thinking about the finished result, what's going to come out of it, you can't really know what that's going to be worth until you've started to understand what's inside the diamond. And you also can't really understand what's going to happen until you know who the client might be for the jewels that are going to come out. So say, for instance, one extremely rich client wants to make the world's largest polished diamond out of this stone. If you wanted to do it, you could do it. If you didn't care about the quality or the absolute whiteness of the stone, you could do that. And someone might pay a huge amount of money to have a stone that's bigger than the one that appears in the Queen's royal scepter. So it could be 50 small jewels. You know, there are all sorts of ways that you could cut and polish this diamond. And until you really know what that is going to look like, you can't really say, you know, what the value of the stone is.
In the meantime, you report that the Sewelo diamond, the rough diamond, is going to tour the world to educate people about the geological history of diamonds. I can't see that happening immediately, can
no.
you?
No, I can't. I think Sewelo is going to stay put for a little while. It's one of these, I mean, it's not the most important thing that's happening because of coronavirus, but it certainly did flash across my mind that Sewelo is not going to go anywhere fast. Maybe they'll wait until till the worst of this crisis abates. I haven't spoken to Ira for a little while, but my belief is that they still want to do that, but they'll just have to wait a little bit.
Your time in Antwerp, did that educate you much about what to look for in a diamond, how to appreciate diamonds?
Oh, it educated me. I'm still, you know, at the level of a 5-year-old child, probably. Yeah, those guys taught me a lot about how to look at diamonds and what you're looking for. But when they tried to explain very fine differences between stones that came from different mines and what to look for at the surface and things about very fine judgments about color and so on, I couldn't see it even with a loop to my eye. And, you know, it does make you realize what a very skilled group of people they are. You know, they've spent their whole lives looking at these tiny things and being able to differentiate between different types of stone.
It didn't make you think the emperor's got no clothes then?
The thing that I found particularly interesting was that when I was shown an extremely valuable cut diamond, so a diamond that had been, you know, made into a pear-shaped and brillianted jewel that cost maybe 25 million US dollars, I was much less impressed by that than the rough, huge rough diamond that I held in my hand. Because the thing that Sewelo makes you feel that a very beautiful pair of earrings does not is the deep sense of the oldness of the planet. So Sewelo was created 3.5 billion years ago, 700 kilometers below the surface of the Earth, was pushed to the surface, or near the surface, by a volcano, essentially. And you're thinking, this big stone existed before there was anything other than single-cell organisms on the surface of the Earth. This has been here before there was life, essentially, before there was, you know, before anything walked. And that is, it's auratic. It has an aura. It feels meaningful to hold something that old.
What are you going to be working on next, Ed, given the extremities of our situation?
Well, luckily, I've just done a lot of travel for a story that I can't quite tell you about because it's a big sort of criminal investigative piece. But, you know, I did all my travel. It was in continental Europe. I spent lots of time abroad doing that. And I got home just as the drawbridge was going up. So my next task is to write up that piece.
In glorious self-isolation.
In isolation. And then after that, who knows? I was meant to be in Africa doing something which might still happen this summer, but it's difficult to make too many predictions. I think in the words of football managers, you take one game at a time. I'm just going to write this piece that I got to write, and then hopefully we'll be up to summer, and maybe some things will change, or maybe they won't, and I'll have to think of something I can do from here.
And that was Ed Caesar.